Welcome to the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of March the 2nd, 2020. Current Federal Tax Developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your State Society of CPAs. This week, we're going to take a look at a few things that happened here in the area of tax, a lot of which have to deal this week. In fact, all of them deal with things that weren't done timely or maybe weren't done timely, two of which are going to be trying to get reasonable cause relief, or at least come up with a reasonable cause why you're not willfully failing to do something. And the third one, we'll look at the question of how we determine if an action's taken late. We'll talk about all three of those here in this week's situation. So let's go ahead and let's move into what will be our first case for the day. And we're going to take a look here at the case of United States versus Ott. This is a case from the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Michigan, case number 218-CV-12-174. The opinion was released on February the 26th, and this particular case involves a taxpayer who had some bank accounts outside the United States. So as you may guess, we're looking at an FBAR situation. So here's the catch. Over the years, and the years in question go back quite a way. Actually, back to beginning in 1993 was when he first opened up the accounts. And eventually, we'll get into an issue where there'll be a problem in 2010. But he established accounts in Canada beginning in 1993. Those accounts grew over time, and ultimately, there were $1.9 million in those accounts. Now, during this time, obviously, we wouldn't have a problem here, except the taxpayer never filed any FBAR reports, and oh, by the way, failed to report the income from these accounts on any of their individual return issues. That was kind of a problem. He also did one other neat thing in the middle of all this. Eventually, at some point, the address on these accounts got transferred to his sister's address in Canada, as opposed to his address in Michigan. Now, there's some dispute as to why that happened. We'll discover that in his initial application for the Offshore Voluntary Disclosure Initiative, he claimed that he had titled it in her name for administrative simplicity. Later on in this case, he was arguing before the court that, she changed that without telling me. I had no idea it had been changed. And she changed the account, had everything sent to her, and I had her on the account in case something happened, and she unauthorized changed it to her address. As you might guess, the question about that sister's address became an issue in the case. And that's why now we have this little issue coming up at this point. So anyway, he used his sister's address to receive the information. Now, in many of these years, it does appear all of them, but a large number of them, he had a CPA, a local CPA, prepare his returns. And this CPA, this guy on paper with what he brought to his CPA, he really didn't appear to be doing that well, didn't have a whole lot of income. In fact, you might even question why he was using a CPA to handle his returns. Wasn't any income there. So it's kind of an interesting issue. But nevertheless, he brought it in every year. And, a lot of us who are CPAs, you have some of those clients who may become part of what are sometimes referred to. I think I heard years ago Walt Haig called them the Widows and Orphans Brigade. Their returns that you, for some reason, they're a friend of somebody. They're a relative of somebody who's a client, and you end up taking on these little returns that, are basically never going to make money off doing the return. It's always going to be a disastrous return to do, but you've got the Widows and Orphans Brigade. So this guy wasn't much above the Widows and Orphans Brigade if he wasn't in the Widows and Orphans Brigade for this CPA. Now, he never mentioned these Canadian accounts to this CPA. And other side of this, the CPA never asked about whether he had foreign bank accounts. So you might wonder, how did they answer the questions on Schedule B? Well, it turns out the CPA never actually answered them, he said, but his software defaulted to answering the questions no. So the questions, now we go in, this has been a problem for us in FBAR cases, where you have a taxpayer who had a return prepared, who filed the return, and they've been filing returns all these years. They have not been filing the FBAR forms. And at the bottom of Schedule B, they've been checking no, no, saying, no, I have no interest in an account outside the U.S. And no, I don't have any worry about filing FBAR. And remember, the Schedule B questions kind of tell you that if you do have these things, you may have to file this foreign bank account reporting form. You should go check that out in the instructions. So this has always been kind of a bad situation, and this is exactly the storm I'd worried about in one sense, because in many cases, CPAs have assumed, CPAs and other tax professionals, have just assumed that if you had a client who, you know, is making minimum wage, whatever, you know, not making a whole lot of money, and they come in, they bring their W-2 in, you know, they bring in their W-2, their $2.50 from a Chase bank account interest in, you know, you figure, I'm not going to ask them about foreign bank accounts, right? Nobody ever asked them. They wouldn't have a foreign bank account. Why would I ask that question? That's just dumb. You know, I'm not going to worry about it. And the problem is the software tends to worry about it. And either the software forces an answer to the question in a diagnostic structure, says, sorry, we're not going forward without it, or it just defaults to no. And so this software defaulted to no. So that would be a problem enough. Okay. But in any event, in 2010, for reasons that aren't, he transferred accounts. And for reasons that aren't totally clear, due to the account transfer, he told his CPA about these Canadian accounts. Now, I suspect the new place that his broker went to may have informed him that these accounts, now, you know, with the U.S. foreign reporting rules that have come into play, that, you know, these accounts were going to essentially be kind of flagged to the IRS that they were U.S.-based accounts, and, you know, with a U.S. owner. And so he's kind of like, uh-oh, gig's up. So in any event, he goes to the CPA. The CPA, of course, now discovers that this is not a good thing. CPA does a very smart thing here. Look, you've got somebody who's about to tell you, who just dropped the bombshell on you that he has $1.9 million sitting in Canada, this guy you thought was broke. And, oh, by the way, he's never told you anything about those accounts, which means right away you're pretty sure there's income that has been on returns. And he's had these since 1991. So, you know, you at this point, you just tell the client to stop talking, right? Because you are now getting to where there are some questions that need to be asked that may have answers that we just don't want to hear as somebody who does not have privilege in criminal matters. I mean, it's bad. 1.9, we're not talking about somebody with, you know, with a, you know, $12,000 account in Canada they're using because, you know, they travel up there every so often. It's not, yeah, it's, no, we're talking about a big account that could have, you know, you got to kind of explain how $1.9 million appeared is one of your issues. So he did recommend that he go see an attorney. Mr. Ott went to see the attorney. She recommended that he enter the Offshore Voluntary Disclosure Initiative Program, OVDI. That is a program the IRS set to allow people to, quote unquote, come in from the cold as long as they did so before the IRS discovered them. If you were ahead of the IRS, you came in from the cold voluntarily, they would let you catch up, right? They would not do criminal charges, right? Okay, that's good news, right? But you did have to pay a statutory penalty and pay all unpaid taxes and get a statutory penalty that was agreed upon. And with the different OVDI programs, that penalty became more significant the longer you had waited. Well, in any event, he went into OVDI. Now, after he went into OVDI, the IRS issued a notice saying, okay, we understand. This is a mechanical one-size-fits-all penalty. It is possible that you might qualify for, due to reasonable cause and lack of willfulness, you might qualify for either no or a reduced penalty. So if you think that the penalty we're talking about here, if you want to take your chances and try it and go what may very well be a lower penalty by going through the traditional process and going through an exam and having us make judgments, if you want to do that, you can. Now, by the time he'd done this, he had already provided the IRS with copies of his original and amended returns for the years in question, statements about all of his Canadian accounts, and the FBAR reports that he was filing late. So the IRS has all that information. He talks about this with the attorney, and look, not clear what the attorney knew, what the attorney didn't know, how the judgment call was made, whether the client was pushing for it against her full advice, whether she just told him to do it, whether, you know, what he had told her. Because remember, this is somebody who had previously been editing materials he was giving the CPA. Would he have been, I hate to say it this way, but sometimes you have to. There are definitely some people who are stupid enough to edit what they tell an attorney who has full privilege, because they know that if they tell the attorney everything, the attorney cannot be a party to a fraud. So the attorney, you know, will, okay, they won't turn him in, right? And they won't be able to testify against him in court, but they're not going to be able to represent them in an IRS exam and lie to the service. So having figured that out, sometimes they decide to edit what they tell the professional. Really, really stupid move to do with the attorney, but nevertheless possible. Or it's possible the attorney made a judgment call error. It's possible, whatever. But if for any event, they decided that it would be better to exit OVDI, or at least he decided ultimately, and they did the exit. So they exited OVDI. They went ahead and went with, we're just going to ask for, here's our cause, here's what happens, here's why we think we should have to pay a penalty that was the size of the OVDI penalty. Understanding that they now are fully subject to all penalties, and those penalties could be way higher than what the OVDI penalty would be. That was why OVDI offered you a chance to come in. IRS didn't have to waste time on you, and you got the chance to get your penalties way lower than they would have been had you basically had the book thrown at you. So he decided to withdraw. Well, the IRS examines his return, and the IRS decides that, you know what? You don't have any reasonable cause for anything here. In fact, you acted willfully. So they eventually propose a penalty for him that's effectively equal to about $1 million. Okay, significantly higher than his OVDI penalty would have been. He's obviously not happy. He pays his penalty, and he then sues for a refund in the district court. And he goes to district court arguing that his stuff was not willful, right? So essentially, he said, look, I didn't act willfully. So, you know, I should at least have the minor $10,000 penalty. Maybe it's not so minor, but compared to $1 million, it's minor penalty. You know, $10,000 penalty for some of the years in question. But not the full-blown penalty, right? Not the willfulness penalty. Well, the court went and looked at a few things. He said, first, of course, look, I know I filed the tax return. And I know it had that thing on Schedule B. And I know it said no. But my CPA has testified that was all an accident. His tax software put that in there. He never asked me about it. I never answered the question. So I really shouldn't be held accountable for that stuff on Schedule B. The court came back and said, no, here's the catch. And he said, and I never read the return. Okay. Court said, sorry, guy, you can't get out of with the I never read the return. Had you looked at any of those returns, had you seen what's on the bottom of Schedule B, and had you read it, you don't have to be, you know, you don't have to have a law degree. You don't have to be a CPA to figure out that it says if you have an interest in a bank account, including a signature authority in a bank account that's not in the U.S., you need to check that yes. That's kind of an obvious question. And then number two, oh, by the way, go read the instructions. You may have all these other filing obligations, you know, and they're significant. They said you should have read that. You had a return. Every year you signed the return under penalties of perjury that all statements were true and complete, which means you'd reviewed it. You can't come in here now and say, sorry, I just didn't read it. You know, hey, what can I say? I didn't read the return. Sorry, it doesn't matter. You know, we didn't necessarily, and the court did not necessarily hold him to the no. Okay, so maybe they bought the idea that this was accidental answer. Maybe they bought the idea that, you know, it just wasn't answered. But the problem is that, yeah, he would have known it in the same issue. So because of that, he said, there's strike one. Had you paid the least bit of attention, had you not been reckless in the way you handled your tax returns, you would have known about this filing. Number two, they said, your failure to discuss your foreign investments with the CPA. They said, look, This is the overwhelming majority of your financial well-being. It was the overwhelming majority of what you lived on. It was large. Again, you don't need to have a law degree. You don't need to be a CPA to realize that that might be income, and maybe I should ask about whether I had to pay tax on it. They said, at best, you were staying willfully ignorant. That is, if I don't ask and he never tells me, then I can claim I don't know that I have to pay tax on it. And they said, staying willfully ignorant, playing ostrich, is not going to cut it. You know, you were willfully ignorant. That's recklessness, right? We're going to say, so that's a willful act. You willfully decided to stay ignorant of whether you had to have an income tax reporting. You based it on your understanding when you admitted you didn't have a clue about any of this, and you hired a CPA because you didn't have a clue. So, yeah, saying that's not going to cut it. And finally, they said the sister's address indicates an intent to conceal. You know, if you're concealing that, that's a willful act. You willfully act to conceal. And they said, and we're not going to let you change your story now. You know, you initially said and you swore to the IRS under penalties of perjury in your statement that you set the address you did for administrative convenience. Now, suddenly, when you realize that it might look bad, you're saying, oh, no, my sister changed it on her own. And I didn't have anything to do with it. They said, first thing is, we don't really care. Secondly, we don't buy the idea that you'd ever looked over there. You know, you constantly had to get it. You had to basically tell, you know, you had to go check that out. It was what you were living off of. It's like, you know, we can't believe, sorry, we're not going to let you be that dumb. We're not going to let you gain from willful ignorance. We're not going to let you gain from having put the account someplace that it's a very reasonable assumption you had assumed meant nobody would find it. So for that reason, the court found he acted willfully, and the entire nice big seven-figure penalty was held to be due. He's not getting that back from the IRS. Now, what this tells us is, first thing, you don't want to be the person who gets a client that you suddenly discover has all these offshore accounts. This is a great illustration that is very dangerous to assume, just based on somebody's income, that they don't have this problem, or based on the income they're telling you. You know, if they're really playing that offshore game, because I have a feeling, had this guy actually told the CPA, I'm pretty sure part of the reason the CPA sent him to the attorney, there's that criminal issue, which is big, but it's also, I've just found out the client's been effectively hiding things from me for decades. That's not a client you want to keep. That's a client you want to fire, right? That's a problem. So it's very good from a liability standpoint, because believe me, I don't doubt that this guy is not going to be upset and is going to be trying to sue somebody for these penalties. And unfortunately, he may very well turn on the CPA and the attorney to attempt to get this money back, claiming that, oh, this is horrible. You should have told me, you know, go to the CPA. You should have told me back in whenever I first got you that we had this foreign bank account issue, that was big. And had you just done so, I would have become, oh, I would have been such a good guy. I would have just gone along, paid the tax. Is he lying? Would he be lying? Maybe. People lie. But it's a problem. So, yeah. So if you believe that you got clients that just wouldn't have a foreign bank account, please remember the story of Mr. Ott. Next up, this is a case of Hunter Maintenance and Leasing Corp. Inc. versus United States. This came from the U.S. District Court of the Northern District of Illinois. Case number 1:18CV06585. This decision came down on February the 27th. This case deals with an officer illness in an S corporation. In this case, we had an S corporation that had a family patriarch who had started all these businesses. Okay. Now, I understand, working with small businesses, that you often see this, right? Dad was successful. Dad started the company, right? And while Dad's alive, Dad controls the company. We may appoint, you know, we may make daughters the president and, you know, and son the secretary, and we may put him on the board. But in reality, we all know that Dad controls all these things. And generally, whatever Dad does is fine. We don't question things, and we just let Dad take care of it. Well, Dad had brought in, and they called this guy kind of the CFO, though he never was really an employee. So they had this other gentleman come in who was an accountant, right, had the accounting background, right, who came in to be what was effectively a chief financial officer. This was a CPA who was, let's say, kind of an outside CFO. Okay. Now, it turns out over the time period in question, both of these gentlemen developed terminal cancer. Now, the CEO, the family patriarch, his was very obvious, well-known. We knew what was going on, and obviously, but he tried to keep control all through that period that he was battling the illness. And I suspect nobody really wanted to stand up to him at any point and say, you know, you're not really able to watch this stuff. We need to step in front. So, you know, dad was there. He was doing that. The CFO also developed cancer, but his wasn't obvious until just before he died, right? Now, in both cases, this became fatal, and both of them had died by the time we discovered the problem, right? The CFO, interestingly enough, had actually prepared all the returns for the years in question, but for reasons that aren't at all clear, and in fact probably confuse even the people left in the company now, it never got filed. You know, I don't know if dad wouldn't sign them. I don't know what the problem was, why it was, but apparently the returns were prepared, the K-1s were all distributed, but the return was never filed. So we have this problem. We have a return that is never filed, even though we had, you know, all of these returns that had been prepared. So like I said, it's weird that they weren't filed, but they weren't filed. And that makes it a little strange. So now we got the problem. We have these unfiled returns for all these years, and we discover now that we're going to owe a lot of money. Okay? After the CFO died, we discovered these returns. And so they were trying to get a waiver of penalties in this case, right? They're trying to get a waiver in this particular case for this S corporation. And we're all aware the penalties for S corporations for failure to file will add up pretty quickly if you have a lot of shareholders and a lot of years. And they had a whole bunch here. Now, the IRS said this is a clear case of the Boyle standard. Now, we've talked about Boyle recently in the past. And Boyle is the decision. We talked about electronic filing issues. Boyle was the Supreme Court case from years ago that held that a taxpayer cannot delegate his or her responsibility to file to a third party. You know, basically, you know that a return needs to be filed by the due date of the return. It takes no great training to understand how to put the return in the envelope, take the envelope to the post office and get it mailed. So they're saying you cannot say, oh, I thought that Harry was taking care of this. You know, I delegate that. They say this is a pure Boyle case, right? So you delegated all responsibility for filing to the person, the CFO. The CFO failed to do so. And like the case in Boyle, which involved an attorney that had failed to file the returns, you know, tough luck. You know, you cannot do it. It was required for somebody to follow up and make sure those returns are actually filed, not just to say, well, we think he took care of it. It's not going to work. So, but the taxpayer said, no, you don't understand. These two were both corporate officers, okay? And they were unable, due to their illnesses, they were unable to comply. That rendered the corporation unable to comply with these rules. And if you're unable to comply, well, then that's reasonable cause. We're looking for reasonable cause to get out of the penalty, right? Now, you may say, wait a minute, there was no harm, no foul, because he kicked out all the K-1s. Doesn't that work? Remember a year ago we discussed the case, the case of ATL. ATL Holdings, as it was called, ATL Holdings and Sons, if I remember the name of the case correctly. That was where an S corporation tried to argue no harm, no foul. As you may remember from that case, that doesn't work, right? The tax court ruled in that case in a published decision that reasonable cause is not based on a no harm, no foul context. You have to come away with cause, reasonable cause, why you didn't file the return. Now, because of that, they didn't argue that here. In fact, the case does mention ATL in one of its sites. It actually cites back to ATL. And I have a feeling they didn't mention it. Now, maybe somebody didn't file it on the return, so you couldn't argue no harm, no foul. But I think very well they decided for ATL that was not going to be a very fruitful way to try to pursue this to claim nobody was hurt. So they went back and said, look, we just couldn't do it. Now, the court says, you know, for an individual, severe illness has been found to be reasonable cause for failure to file. But they say, but a corporation is a different beast. And the court said, look, for a corporation, you have the officers as a whole. The court said there have been very, very limited cases, in fact, one, where a corporation was found to be rendered unable to comply due to its officers' bad conduct. But they said it's been very, very rare. The court said there are a slew of other cases where just because an officer didn't do something, the Boyle standard got applied. And the court said in this case in particular, you had other officers. You had presidents, and you had other officers. You had board members, other board members besides Dad. All of those had a responsibility to make sure the company kept running. They all in charge of running the company, right, as a group. And so even if Dad was disabled, and even if the CFO was disabled, and even if it was reasonable to treat the CFO as the officer, even though he was kind of an odd position, it doesn't matter. The other officers and the other directors dropped the ball. Now, you realize that probably would have been a problem for any of those people, because I wouldn't doubt they were officers in name only and directors in name only, that Dad actually controlled everything. You know, let's face it, we've seen that multiple times. But it doesn't matter. If you're going to play with the fiction of a corporation, that it's a corporation and not just an unincorporated entity, you're going to get that legal protection. You got to play by the rules. And this is one of the rules. Now, think interestingly enough, had this actually not been incorporated, had Dad just run all of these as proprietorships, good chance that there'd been reasonable cause for Dad not filing. Now, they also came back at the end and said, but wait, Dad had a bunch of companies, and the IRS for some of the other companies granted us reasonable cause relief. And so they really need to do so here. Well, the court said, A, that's not this case in front of me. B, doesn't require that to happen. C, I don't know if those facts are like this. And like you said, the law as applied is right. And frankly, to be totally honest, the IRS may have just been wrong in waiving in those cases. So be aware of that. And this, I think, illustrates a point that I've heard a lot of practitioners over the years say, oh, don't worry about that. The IRS never assesses that penalty. Don't worry about that. I've gotten out of it multiple times. Don't worry about that. You got to watch that. Don't worry about that based on IRS practice. You know, yes, these guys have cases where they succeeded in getting it, but they didn't succeed in this case. Why not? I don't know. But the problem was, as the court said, the law allows the penalty to go forward. The law does not require this to be seen as reasonable cause. And because of that, the court saying, tough luck. I don't care about those other cases. I don't care that you got it 99 times, that you got this waived the 100th time the book's thrown at you. Tough luck. That's just the way it works. Okay. So you got to be careful with that. You know, understanding practicality of what they're actually doing is useful, but please always understand what they could do. Because as was found in Hunter Maintenance, sometimes they do what they could do, even though you previously not had a problem with the issue. Final case this week is actually a non-case. The Supreme Court decided not to hear the case of Baldwin versus United States. This was on the Supreme Court's order list, the denials of petition for certiorari that was issued on February the 24th of 2020. Now, the Baldwin case is a case out of the Ninth Circuit, and we've discussed the Baldwin case before. The Baldwin case involves the simple question, and we're going to key it down. We're not going to go through the whole Baldwin issues again. I want to go to the key issue. The key issue that we have to deal with here is that the IRS has a regulation, right? And we have a code section. Code section 7502 tells us about the timely mailing is timely filing rule. You all have heard about that, right? If you mail your return by the due date of the return, right? And it's not really how the rule reads, but that's how people talk about it. So as long as you mail your return by April 15th this year, it will be timely filed if you're an individual return, or at least you mail your extension by then. Okay, fine. But what it actually says, which you understand, is a postmark's applied. Okay, it's based on the postmark, so that's not really the same as mailing. You cannot drop it in the mailbox at 11:59 p.m. You may have mailed it on April 15th, 11:59 p.m., but yeah, it's not going to get postmarked, and that's going to be a problem. But the other catch is, as we all know, what happens if the letter just disappears, right? I put my return in the mailbox and it never gets delivered. That's happened. I've had it happen at my office multiple times, you know, where we had a few years ago, a check for me that was coming from Nichols Patrick, you know, disappeared. It was about a $20,000 check that I was getting for, you know, for all the year-end work and various other things I'd been doing. I was like, I had about $20,000 to pay me for all kinds of things I've been doing. And it's like it just got disappeared entirely. It never appeared anywhere, right? These things happen. How do we fix that? You know, what happens if that's my return? Well, the regulations tell us specifically that, you know, how you do it. The law says you can either send it registered mail, okay, and then, or you could send it using certified mail. In either case, the receipt with the stamped postmark given to you by the Postal Service employee is sufficient to prove timely mailing and therefore timely filing. The section also goes on to talk about electronic filing and e-postmark counting as the same thing. Okay, that'll prove timely filing. Now, up until 2011, the IRS didn't really have any reg explaining was this the only way to do it, or was this the, or was this just a way, you know, a way for sure it would work, but you could submit other evidence. In 1991, the Ninth Circuit held in the Anderson case that this was just a way to lock it down, and you could still provide other proof of timely application of the postmark, right? Timely mailing. And if you did that, then we had the presumption of delivery to the IRS, even if you didn't have a certified mail receipt. Now, in 2011, right? So basically 20 years later, the IRS finally issues a regulation that held that the only way you could have 7502 timely filing coverage was by using one of the specified methods. So that means registered mail, the white receipt, right? The white receipt they give you when you mail. Gang, we don't care about the green card. I always tell people, the green card's irrelevant because if that gets lost, the green card's not coming back either. Okay, or the white receipt from certified mail, that's added by the reg, that would work, because the law just says registered and the IRS could provide how certified work. They just made certified look like registered there. So if I don't have either one of those, I didn't use electronic filing, there is no other way to prove filing. Underline, three times, bold-faced, italicized, no other way to prove timely filing. If the IRS says they didn't get the envelope, or the envelope didn't have a postmark, right? Or it didn't have a postmark and it arrived after the normal mailing time, because that's also in the reg. So let's say, or you metered it and it didn't arrive in the normal mailing time, because that's also not protected. Tough luck. You late filed. You might not be able to get your petition into court. In the case of Baldwin, they lost their chance to claim a refund because they were after the due date of the claim for refund coming in. If I remember the Baldwin case exactly, you know, that's it. Tough luck. You're there. And, you know, understand that very clearly, because you'll have people say, oh, you can trace certified mail on the IRS website. You don't need the piece of paper. Oh, you can trace it here. Gang, great, but the reg says you got to have that receipt. I don't care what else you have. And you'll say, but I've gotten it waived multiple times by giving them a copy of that. True. Remember Mr. Ott, right? The fact it's worked doesn't mean it will work. The fact they let you go doesn't mean they'll always let you go. So the white document or electronic filing are your ways of doing it. Then now the question is, but wait, I told you, the Ninth Circuit said we could introduce some of that other proof. Well, the problem the Ninth Circuit said was now the IRS put this regulation out. In Anderson, we said the law wasn't clear. Now, generally, regulations, here's the case, under the Chevron test, and there's lots of dispute whether the Supreme Court will revisit this, and that's kind of what this dealt with. Under the Chevron test, though, if the law, if Congress does not speak to the situation in question, and we're all clear, Congress did not speak to that here, whether this was the exclusive way of doing it, whether it's just one way of doing it, Congress didn't speak to the issue. And if the IRS and if the agency issues a regulation that is a reasonable interpretation of the law, doesn't have to be the best, it just has to be reasonable. There can be other reasonable interpretations, but as long as their interpretation is reasonable, then that is how the law is going to work, period. That came from the Chevron case. And Brand X was a case that came, well, what happens if a case like this? We have court cases that already said it works like this. Then the agency now comes back in and resolves the ambiguity later and comes up with a decision that's at odds with the court decision. Does the court have to follow the agency? And in Brand X, issued in the mid-2000s, the Supreme Court, an opinion penned by Justice Thomas, and we'll get to why that's important here in just a second, told us that, yes, the agency had to follow the regulation. Ninth Circuit said our hands are tied. Supreme Court says we've got to follow the IRS reg. So, sorry, Anderson doesn't count. We can't follow Anderson. We have to go along with the reg, and sorry, you guys are late. The taxpayers took this up because there's been a lot of speculation. The Supreme Court would like to rehear Brand X. Unfortunately, not in this case. The Supreme Court denied certiorari. Now, what's interesting is Justice Thomas issued a dissent. And that's interesting because, remember, he was the author of the Brand X decision, and he's now saying, I kind of got that wrong. Brand X was wrongly decided, and it's become a problem, and I think we should have revisited Brand X. Now, a lot of people think, not only is the court going to revisit Brand X, but the court, you know, could very well revisit Chevron. But here's kind of where it comes up. I have a feeling maybe the court wants to revisit Brand X. Other members of the court may want to go there besides Justice Thomas. But in this case, the problem is, had the court gone there and had the court said, okay, sorry, once they're, you know, nope, Brand X is wrong. The court already had a precedent. Tough luck, IRS. You can't change the precedent. But the problem was other circuits had the exact opposite precedent. And that's kind of, this makes this a bad case to be your poster child to overturn Brand X. Because it would say the only way to resolve that is for the Supreme Court to take it up. And by the way, the Supreme Court hates tax cases. So they, either going to have to allow for their different rules all throughout the country, and the IRS can't solve that by issuing a reg, or they're going to have to actually pick up all these tax cases, which they don't want to pick those up anyway. So while I understand Justice Thomas's complaint, I don't know that we're done with Brand X. I just think that this was, there were obviously, they just looked at all the problems that they'd have to deal with after if they reverse this thing and decided we're not doing that. We don't want to do tax cases. We're out of here, right? We're just not going to do that one. In any event, remember, get the white piece of paper. If your client files a tax return by mail, they're not electronically filing, either because they don't want to or they can't, get the white slip of paper from the Postal Service employee. That is the only way that they can prove timely filing. That, I don't care about the green card. You can do whatever you want with the green card. But get that white receipt. The regulation is clear, and effectively the Supreme Court has said, yeah, we're going to let that stand, at least for now. So certainly those of us here in the Ninth Circuit, you better go get that piece of paper. Well, like I want to remind you, we do this as live CPE. The advantage of live CPE is that we can keep you up to date on things that happen all during the time. We can keep you up to date on something that came out the day before. We're going to be doing live CPE all through this coming year. You know, take a look. We'll do it either live, which means with people in the room, or we're going to be doing it broadcast live. So you can do a live session. We will broadcast many of them. Generally, every course I do for Arizona that is done in Phoenix gets broadcast from their office. I also do other courses that tend to be broadcast from various other state societies. So take a look at those broadcast courses too. Done live, and I mean really live, not rebroadcast live. Rebroadcasts are fine, but live has an advantage of being able to react to things that happened when the course was there, and you don't worry about the fact that, well, when was this course written? Or when was the materials put together, that you do in self-study and even to a lesser extent rebroadcast. So, you know, take a look at those live courses. The state societies will be putting those catalogs out here soon. Go ahead, consider signing up for one of them with us. I'd love to see you at a course, or at least see you online on a broadcast. you know, and get that together. We're going to have lots of things to talk about. We've got regulations coming up. You know, we're still waiting on those 163J regs, and that's going to cause a lot of discussions coming up. So, you know, those things are coming. We're going to get the carried interest proposed regs out here soon. We're going to be seeing all kinds of things happen, and then just try to deal with the regular tax issues we've got all the time. So be sure to check that out with what we're setting up now with our state societies for this year's CPE courses. You can catch our updates on the website, currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, online. I post there as I see things of interest during the week, usually the stories I'm going to talk about here on the weekly broadcast. You can also send questions and comments to me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. That is the best address by far. If you want to send me something related to this, you know, this broadcast or to the CPE courses, because that's why I'm in CP mode. I've got clients in regular practice that I pay more attention to on the other email addresses, so this is the best one to send that to. You can follow me on Twitter. I post at Ed Zollers. Also in Reddit, I'm on /r/taxpros. I'm there watching, and I'll answer, pop in on a few questions. I also follow along with the California Society's Listserv Tax Talk and with the Connect groups for the Arizona, Minnesota, and New Jersey societies. So if you want to pop into one of those, you know, have an issue and I see something I think I can help with, I'll try to pop in. Otherwise, hey, week's kind of done. You know, we're here. You know, we finished up this week. We got another week coming. You know, we know already a few things will happen. We do expect to have at least the carried interest proposed regs out next week, or hopefully, because they've left OIRA. We'll tell you if we see what those are. We'll talk about some other issues coming up. Could be some things of interest. Again, we're getting into it. We're getting close to the first filing deadline. You know, the excitement of March 15th for the S-Corps and partnership. So that's coming up. And all the other fun stuff. So be ready. We'll be here and we'll talk to you more about what's going to be going on in the area of current federal tax development.